introduce our speaker for today. Let me remind you of the next few colloquium in this series. So next week we have Vincent Levesu, I hope I pronounced that right, who is from Paris and will be talking about mathematical physics, recent progress in renormalization in mathematical physics. And after that we have Fanshi Wen from MIT talking about condensed matter physics approach to the emergence of gauge fields, photons, gluons, and gravity. And then after that, the week after that, we'll have one of our sessions in the bistro where we talk to each other. So that's the next 3 weeks. Today, it's an enormous pleasure to welcome Sarah Diamond here. Sarah is a visual artist to begin with and is very influential and well known as a visual artist. For example, and this impressed me, I don't know how much she is in the, her work, that is not her, but her work is in the collection of Museum of Modern Art in New York, the National Gallery of Canada, and many other places. Before coming to our neighborhood, she was at the Banff Center, where she was the founder of, I think, the New Media Center, Banff New Media Institute, and the artistic director there. She has taught also in a long list of places I won't mention. And a few years ago, came to the Ontario College of Art and Design, which is the premier school in art and design in our area, as the president. And
which must be a challenging
position. Yeah. And Sarah, it's, let me just remark that Sarah, in all of her work that I know about artistically, or much of her work, she's been interested in interactions, in collaborations, in clashes and constructive collaborations amongst different directions, communities, including, as we'll see, art and science. And she's somebody who shakes things up. And from what I hear, she's been shaking things up in Toronto ever since she came. So we're very happy to have her here for the day. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. Can everyone hear me okay? I tend to be able to project without a microphone, which I think is one of the qualities you have to be a president of a post-secondary institution. So what I what I wanted to do today was speak from a little bit of my ethnographic historian sociology background, as well as the collaborative arts context. So I'm one of those strange people with multiple attention disorders. So I have a number of different degrees and have researched in different areas. So my first degree was in history and ethnographic history, and it then compelled me to be very interested in contemporary ethnography. And ethnographers essentially study cultures and try and understand how the cultures function, their rules, their modes of exchange. And then also in 21st century ethnography often engage directly with those cultures in shaping the ways that structures and discourses occur. So there's certainly a part of contemporary art practice that has internalized that way of working. And in my work as a video artist in the last century, I can actually say that, it's so great. And then as a software artist, which I will talk about, I very much approach things also from that kind of ethnographic perspective. So on a certain level, I've been studying scientists and engineers for a long time, but in a way where it's very engaged. So what I thought I would talk about today, and I was sort of hoping to, you know, show you some things, advance some concepts, maybe show you a little bit from a project that I did over many years that had a particular moment in 2003 that I thought you might be quite entertained by. I really wanted to have a conversation about how we work together from different disciplinary frameworks, and the we not just being artists and scientists or engineers and designers and artists and scientists, but over lunch, we began a little bit of a conversation about experimentalists and theorists. And I just thought it'd be interesting to talk about the things that you've encountered from your world in cross-disciplinary dialogues and exchanges and see how much we could learn from each other there. So I did put the H and the M very consciously as big things of how much do we need to understand each other to work together. That's my school. I'm going to talk about a concept which is the boundary object. That's one of 10 buildings, and you know we're actively trying to get the money to build 4 more beautiful buildings in Toronto. This particular building itself was highly contested when it came into Toronto. People saw the sketches, and it was in the Globe and Mail, and made lots of obscene comments about it. It was way too radical for the Toronto architectural scene at this time. And now it's heralded as the building that kicked off the Toronto architectural revolution. And I think it's just a great metaphor because it really is in between the disciplinary context of art and design in the sense that it is an abstract, beautiful building. Yet it's material and it's real. And it looks incredibly delicate because it does stand on these stilts that are incredibly well engineered, in fact. And the building is 100% earthquake proof. Perhaps more than most buildings in Toronto. And not that there's a lot of earthquakes in Toronto, but you know, you never know. Yet it's very solid. And so it kind of works between the space of beauty and complexity, and it looks very fragile, and yet it's very solid. So it's a very nice discourse between art and design, in a sense, and all of the science that goes behind making that building stand up. So you know, things that are probably banal but worth repeating. Are that contemporary research requires very diverse disciplinary knowledge. Now, I actually wrote a paper because I'm that kind of relentless academic, but I'm going to try and not read from it. I think we know that, you know, complex issues and questions require people to approach them who have quite siloed knowledge at times and find a way of being able to bring those things together. So. I did show the utopian landscape of Banff because Banff was a very particularly credible place to bring people together from different kinds of knowledge because you could suspend your disbelief and be in the beauty of nature and be physically engaged, walk, talk. Many of the architectural effects that a building like this has where frankly, architects really think through how you build collaborative spaces. I mean, Perimeter's famous for how it's architected, that it, you know, has these little nooks and places where you can sit with chalkboards and talk and all that. So nature, in a sense, was Banff's palette for that. This sort of pressure towards interdisciplinarity, which is, I think, present in almost all of the sciences now, you know, 300 names on papers when they're published, et cetera. All of those challenges there are also very much between disciplines. But I think one of the pressures, and you have this miraculous freedom in some ways from it in this institute, but for those of us who've been engaged in the research world, and I actually became the director of research at Banff, and a lot of what I did was bring people together from very different kinds of disciplinary knowledge. There's a lot of pressure for instrumental, you know, results these days, for things that are easily quantified and have a direct sort of impact in terms of innovation. So even the space of art and science collaboration, which has a very long and regal history, now is sort of under pressure to produce. So some of what's interesting, though, within many of the problems that we're trying to solve as interdisciplinary scholars and as researchers and artists and scientists, designers, et cetera, who come together to work, is that you actually need to develop new methodologies to approach the quality of problems that we're trying to address together. And so that, and I'm going to talk, I think, a fair amount about that, and I've got little pieces of artwork sprinkled through here that all of which were pieces that required a lot of interdisciplinary knowledge to produce. So, but in order to be able to solve those problems, you need to absolutely break with some of the, the traditional methodologies that one has brought to the table and yet kind of have a toe in that water of where you come from in order to, you know, bring that knowledge forward. So one of the areas I've worked with a lot in the last 4 years. And I probably won't have time to show you this project, but it's in building location-based experiences using mobile phones. This is sort of something that, you know, I should be talking about because this is RIM Central, right? But one of the problems of building things on a mobile phone, there's all the design challenges, but we were building really large-scale kind of adventures that have this amazingly sort of experiential quality to them. And we actually developed a way of working on location in the physical environment and inventing a whole lot of pieces of software and tools and ways of actually working in a space where you're designing in that space. And we were working with games designers who were like top-tier designers who came onto the project who had always been able to build these fantasy worlds using graphics that were, you know, in the platform game space. And suddenly they're working in a location that's incredibly rich and has all of this happening in and around them. And how do you get people to have an experience there that interacts with what is a fairly chaotic environment that has a lot less control? So you design in location. You look at all of the qualities. You're also dealing with the problems of GPS and satellites and what a phone can do. So together, we actually began to develop a whole set of methodologies, which I would describe as location storming, where you, instead of brainstorming, you actually work within a physical, locative, actual environment. And you build on the set and in the site. And then you take that back into the lab and you engineer from there. And the second quality of a lot of the cultures that those of us who are building anything in the cultural world are dealing with is, you know, the history of the artist working alone in their studio and making an artwork for not even an imagined audience, but as a mode of expression. We're not in a culture that works that way anymore. Culture is extremely participatory. Your audiences live in a social media space online. And there's a kind of expectation of engagement and dialogue and transformation of an art or cultural experience that's very much against the idea of a kind of unique vision. So the knowledge models are shifting in many ways that we're looking at. In thinking about collaboration in a sort of interdisciplinary context, and this is sort of where I'm interested in the dialogue around your own experiences, there's a lot of literature that comes out of sociology that talks about the notion of cohesion. And cohesion was a term that in the 19th century, and if you want all the sort of academic citations, I can give them to you. I don't know how interesting that will be for you. But the discourse around cohesion really came out of Western European societies and then the United States, kind of looking at how is it that, you know, within capitalist systems, a sense of collectively agreed to goals could emerge for a nation state. So cohesion became a term that looked at, you know, when people could kind of agree with each other about what they wanted to do, and you could kind of set them on that train, and they could then achieve based on this social vision that was shared, the nation state would be a powerful entity, and you would move forward, and science would be successful, and so would the economy, and so on. So cohesion then becomes this term that begins to fragment and is highly fragmented in the world that we live in. If you think about the sort of breakdown of the nation state, I know some of you were thinking about new economic models today. Well, we're living through, you know, the failure of the idea of a national economy in any way in terms of where the nation state and the global economy fits. So cohesion is no longer a national project or even possible in many ways. we're in a highly globalized context, and we've learned to become incredibly specialized in our knowledge. And yet I was just talking about a world in which we need to work together to solve complex problems. So this notion that's kind of emerged, which is very interesting from a philosopher, a German philosopher, whose name is Flusser, who's worked a lot with looking at technology emergence and teams that work together, is the notion of intersubjectivity. And the idea of intersubjectivity, which I have a lot of affection for this term, is one where you, in a sense, build a new kind of identity that's much more experiential. It emerges from the process of working together within a context that has boundaries around it of identities and knowledge and time, and yet is highly reciprocal. So that's sort of why I posed this question in the beginning of, you know, how much do we need to really understand each other or know each other? And I guess I'm still really struggling with that question. So, and I'll come back to this notion of intersubjective identities. And I want to then introduce these ways of thinking about what begins to bring into being an identity or a way of working in a lab, let's say, that has this notion of this negotiated cohesion, you know, where you you have a bounded sense of who you are as an entity, and it can come and it can go. So sociologists and ethnographers have come up with this notion of the boundary object, and it traditionally comes from looking at what happens when two cultures meet and the role of the gift within the process of cultures and different kinds of knowledge systems meeting up against each other. And so they also can be gifts between spaces. So traditionally, there's a notion of a gift of exchange that people invest in. So I got here and I was given a mug and a scarf and a card and an office, which I thought was very generous. So in a sense, that's Perimeter's gift to me, and then I have to reciprocate that and construct something from my culture into the Perimeter culture, which I guess is this talk. So what happens, though, within the process of boundary objects is that as these get exchanged, they themselves, the object, becomes something that's quite different. So I suppose some of the work that's happening here really fits into that space around different sorts of theories within the world of physics. What begins to happen when you're building something within an interdisciplinary collaboration is that you begin to emerge a set of concepts and ontologies, so new categories that begin to reflect your shared practice. So, you know, when we start to talk, and maybe I'll stop in a few moments and just make sure that we're understanding each other, that practice begins to actually transform language and transform representation. And I'll just give an example of the ways that a culture was transformed very much by something that engineers built. So everybody in the room, I'm sure, has a mobile phone, smartphone, probably, frankly, a BlackBerry. Back in the day when mobile phones were being generalized, they were constructed by engineers, and the SMS texting capacity was put on the phone so engineers could communicate with each other about points when cell reception was breaking down, right? So it was absolutely something built for engineers. And then Finnish teenagers, who are notoriously social, if there's any Finns in the room, I've worked a lot with the Finns, and I love working with them, so please don't think this is a terrible generalization, but there's a lot of sociological research on this. So so let's say it may be an urban myth, but it certainly has some fairly decent documentation. So Finnish teenagers who tend to not like to talk to each other face-to-face, there's this beautiful image actually that Nokia put together of two teens with their backs to each other, a girl and a boy, and they were texting each other. So essentially, in two cultures that have weird social relationships between genders, the UK and Finland, men and women began to text message each other with SMS text. The Finns literally in the same space, I mean back to back, and the Brits, you know, like, having been on their mobile phone on the train forever, finally figured out they could text. So suddenly there's this amazing transition where a piece of a technology, a capacity, is overtaken by you know, people within the culture and is transformed into something else. So now we all SMS text, except it's really hard to text on a BlackBerry for those of us who come out of that, because you're supposed to do email. But anyhow. So this artwork is kind of fun because it's a fabulous long story of a kind of a boundary object project in many ways because it transformed two cultures. So Mark Hansen is a very brilliant statistician who now teaches at UCLA, but he was at the Bell Labs. And Ben Rubin is a really great composer. And they got together and they created this artwork, which is very beautiful, and perhaps at some point you'll have a chance to see it. Perimeter should bring it here because it would kind of fit with the aesthetic. And it's, for various reasons, it's a very poignant work. It's one of those works that people, believe it or not, sort of sit in front of and start to cry sometimes. And it's made up of chats. So it's basically taking feeds off of chats and SMS text messages that it's picking up. And it kind of filters them for keywords that are all about kind of love and relationship. And it's, so it's got this incredible poignancy. So it's people sort of trying to, through, you know, all this technological mediation, connect with each other somehow. And it's called a listening post. And it plays music that is generated through sampling through these texts. And it runs little bits of them across the screen. And the light is absolutely mesmerizing and beautiful. And it's a boundary object in many ways, because it's really it was a really brilliant breakthrough work in terms of how to do statistical sampling from which of course is all kinds of other sorts of applications, from text messages and chats. And you know, it was built between 1999 and 2000, and you know, things have moved forward since then technically. And then for the composer, it was you know, a way of him and the artist Ben Rubin, a way of him being able to kind of take his ability as a composer and move it into this other space. So for both of the collaborators, it broke through their knowledge. It was incredibly difficult to do. It made Bell Labs absolutely crazy. It was one of those projects where every notion that they had about intellectual property and who owns what was completely contradicted through this collaboration, because they couldn't figure out who owned the creative knowledge. You know, was it the artist? Was it the scientist, the statistician, the computer scientist? So it actually created a new model for being able to work together at Bell Labs. Of course, Mark eventually left and went to UCLA. But and so it was an interesting project to kind of look at, because you could say that that artwork itself is a boundary object. It brings together the force of knowledge from two domains. Mark did not become a composer or an artist, although I would say that his sense of aesthetic judgment and his awareness of aesthetics is phenomenally changed. I mean, I know I've kind of watched his career over the years. And Ben now has a kind of tactical, substantive knowledge of computer science. So there's a way where what happened was they had to build this sort of intersubjectivity, which is enough of a capacity to understand each other, to be able to share, in a sense, an identity, and to continue to work together. And they've gone on to make a lot of brilliant projects. So so one of the things that's interesting, Michael Sentry, who's a very interesting sociologist, new media theorist, studied laboratories like the ones that we built at Banff or exist at Waterloo that really do bring together arts and sciences. And he looked at them from a very instrumental perspective, how much invention came out of these labs. Frankly, a lot. You know, where did it end up going? A lot of it was eventually commercialized, et cetera. So all those things you want to put on a grant application, I suppose. But also, he was able to sort of look at some of the people who had been involved in collaboration. And Tom Calvert and Tekla Shipforce, who Tom is a computer scientist. He was one of the Canadian computer scientists to ever first work with artists. And Tekla is an incredible choreographer. And she began to work with Tom, and she actually went and did another degree in computer science because she was so kind of intrigued by the knowledge that he represented, but primarily wanted to keep making work from the perspective of being a choreographer. And they worked together for about 20 years. And what they both describe is this sort of process of becoming a creative unit, where in a way they were marked by sameness. And the frisson of the new, the frisson, I think I didn't spell it right, was of the new was gone. Their shared identity meant that they were actually kind of creating a new way of working and a new kind of knowledge. And it kind of lost, they were like a married, like they say, they were like a married couple. And that kind of sexiness of, you know, different knowledge domains actually having to negotiate all the time was lost from their collaboration. And they ended up building a whole lot of software that was very successful. But I'm not sure the artwork and the science continued to be as tough as it was when there was that friction. So again, that's another question is, you know, what does it mean to have these sort of different ways of looking at the world? And how do we retain that sense of difference at the same time as we look at areas of challenge? So conversation is a place where people build boundary objects. Boundary objects need to account for heterogeneity. I've said a lot of this. The boundary is the place where new knowledge is traditionally produced, you know, traditionally produced from new knowledge. But, you know, if you study where new knowledge comes from, it's often in these places where systems of looking at the world, thinking about the world, actually come up against each other. The Bell Labs history is an interesting one because in the 1960s, Billy Kluver, who ran the Bell Labs, started Bell Labs, invited Robert Rauschenberg, who was one of the American artists of his generation, most exciting, amazing artist, to begin to work with him. And what Kluver said was, which I thought was funny, he used this term, the use of the engineer by the artist. Most engineers I know would like not like that particular sentence, but in any case, the use of the engineer by the artist will stimulate new ways of looking at technology and dealing with life in the future. So he had this idea that through collaboration, engineering would be inspired but wouldn't have to become artistic. And artists would continue to make work but would, in a sense, you know, throw problems at engineers that they found it difficult to solve. And one of the things that he talked a lot about was the need to be able to fail continually. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about artists and scientists in particular and why it's very difficult sometimes for us to work together. But the idea of placing sort of things together means that you have to come up, and this is where artists are very useful to scientists, I think, is artists have the need to make things and express things and find something tangible out of a collaboration. And they tend to drive towards that. And even artists who think in the most conceptual way and make the most conceptual artwork still need to, part of the nature of art practice is a kind of desire for not necessarily emotional expression, but expression, the need to make something tangible. And so there's a way where those tangible things, again, become ways of looking at and finding a common language. And then collaboration requires empathy and imagination and being able to project your knowledge into another's knowledge domain. So some of the problems, though, and they're really pretty fundamental problems, actually, that I find very interesting is that there are obviously very different methodologies between the arts and the sciences. But artists and theoretical artists and theoretical scientists both work from philosophy. So there's a way where there's a philosophical common ground, often even sometimes the same philosophy. Artists who work in speculative ways are often incredibly engaged with theory, you know, consume a lot of theory, a lot of philosophy, also visually have an incredible kind of knowledge of visual strategies or material strategies, but then work in very speculative ways where they produce something, it's bounded or grounded within that theory, but they can't, they have to absolutely reverse engineer how they explain it. But they're not expected to provide a logical and rational explanation at quite the same level as sciences. And speculative science has a very different challenge than artists. Artists are supposed to do a unique work that is standalone in many ways and is grounded in that knowledge and that theory. And artists are criticized if they repeat. So if you have a career where you iterate and iterate and iterate, you probably will fall from you know, the International Biennale scene or the Museum of Art and Modern Art collection, frankly. So part of your credibility as an artist is to be successful in different, in continually differentiating from what you've done before. Part of the success for science, including speculative science, is to be able to explain why something is created. This is at least my observation from working with scientists and observing. And then to be able to at least reverse engineer the methodology description. So even if, in fact, the realization of a breakthrough comes from very non-rational processes in terms of how creativity actually unfolds, scientists still have to defend what they do. And then you have to repeat it until it's credible, to push it and repeat it and iterate. So I think some of what's very interesting in this sort of dance between art and science is how, you know, people who have a compulsion to always create something that's unique work with people who have a compulsion to create something that is repeatable. And, you know, where that common space is. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit. And then, as I mentioned, so there's a problem about failure. And yet, in collaboration, you absolutely have to fail. Every significant collaboration I've been involved with has had significant failure from which you begin to build that common culture and you really create new rules of order where you say, this is what values to us as a team. But you don't get there easily. You get there by failing consistently. And then the aesthetics between art and science are highly speculative. There isn't a common set of aesthetic boundaries. There still is, I think art has engaged with an incredibly focused, language-based, precise way of thinking about practice in the 21st century that often involves a lot of background in social science and linguistics and form. And science has its own trajectories of knowledge. So finding an aesthetics that works for scientists, which is beautiful for a scientist, and finding an aesthetic that is beautiful for an artist is a very kind of difficult, interesting ground. And again, coming back to my first question, is that what we need to do together? Or are there different things that one can extract from a collaboration, the science that one learns from trying to represent a theory or an understanding, and the art that one learns from working with a scientist and trying to take that knowledge into something that's abstract or represented? So I think I've sort of said there's a lot of other challenges. Art is very much based in context and interpretation. And the heterogeneity of readings versus the idea that you would ever make a work that was correct or true. Artwork is often deemed successful if it has multiple readings. So it's supposed to be able to be unique, yet be read in different ways. And there's also extremely different views on appropriation and citation. 21st century art practice, 20th century art practice, beginning with the Dada movement in the 1920s, was all about taking an image and transforming it into something else. And then taking something that exists and transforming it into yet another thing. Now, science, of course, also appropriates and cites, but art often is successful by inferring its histories as opposed to citing its histories. And one of the things artists love to do is to appropriate scientific theory and to misuse it in many ways. So there's also that really interesting kind of friction there. So I do want to give you some case studies, but I thought I would open up the conversation a little bit about just your experiences with working between disciplines. And I'm just sort of curious whether any of this resonates with you and your sense of what the boundary objects are in the science that you're involved with or in your work with others from other disciplinary areas. And then I'll entertain you, I hope, by showing you some case study things.
Well, it seems to me that in working with a number of disciplines, that a lot of collaboration work has to start with kind of creating common cultural spaces. you know, whether it's food or you know, it's kind of, it's less about exchanging of objects and exchanging of common experiences that then can allow you to build the common basis for talking to mm-hmm. each other. So you talk about exchanging gifts, but it's for me, it's been more about sitting down to dinner.
Yeah.
Going for a hike with, you know, a walk in the woods with people who have, on the, you know, on the face of things, don't have anything in common.
Mm-hmm.
But those experiences, since they're common to all of us, are a place to start.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, a lot of the studies of, you know, what works in interdisciplinary lab environments are the kind of social interactions between people. But, you know, in my own experience as well, and I think Perimeter is, you know, I had lunch here, which was good, so I can't make bad generalizations, but, it, you know, there was certainly a history, you know, in the late 20th century where computer scientists and engineers would tend to live on pizza and Coke, and artists would be, like, very interested in kind of, you know, vegetarian food. I'm generalizing. So there was even this sort of friction between the kind of food cultures that people would have. But definitely going for a walk in the woods helps, but then you have to actually sit down and start to do something else. So you can look at, you know, boundary spaces and labs that very interestingly try and really reflect different kinds of cultures so that people are comfortable within those spaces and able to work together. But ultimately, there's this other sort of problem, you know, with language. And I mean, one of the examples I love to give is the word artifact, which has, you know, at least three different meanings. If you have and I've actually been in the room with a cross-disciplinary team of graphics scientists, computer scientists, ethnographers, and Aboriginal cultural theorists. And artifacting for a graphics, computer graphics scientist is the worst nightmare in the world. I mean, it's the thing you want to erase and get rid of. For an artist, to be able to produce an artifact within a graphic space and a computer graphic space is a way of creating a trace of identity and self. So artists love to figure out ways of messing up graphic systems and pulling artifacts and histories out of there. So you already have this tension around how an artifact is understood and described. You know, for an ethnographer who's working in that mix, an artifact is a great thing because it kind of represents this notion of, you know, a cultural trace. It's a way of understanding the culture, it's a boundary object, it's whatever. And for an Aboriginal person, an artifact is the way they've been described by archaeologists and ethnographers and reduced to a culture that's no longer living. So, you know, you introduce the word artifact and you suddenly have people having this sort of boundary fight about interpretation and meaning. And I'm sure in science that has happened all the time where there's these terms. So I'm very interested in how one creates ways of breaking through that. And one of the things that I think artists have done is to create sketches and models and very tangible things where people can go, wow, that feels really good. That's really interesting. And, you know, I see my idea there, or I feel that idea there. This thing has a sort of stretchiness that represents a concept I'm trying to understand. And even though it's taking scientific knowledge and interpreting it through the human body, in a sense, because when you're looking at something, it is about the body. You know, if you're feeling something, it has that sort of tangibility. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've just been thinking, I mean, a lot of what we talk about here, you know, on the level of what Perimeter is about, is to encourage people within a very narrow range of disciplines to work together and to talk together. And my sense is that it's, sorry, two things. One is that it's harder than it looks. And we here represent a pretty narrow range of trainings and backgrounds. And even so, people tend to fall into, you know, even narrower communities. And a lot of, for example, if you walk around the building, a lot of the design of the building was made to encourage people to accidentally encounter each other. A lot of things we do here are designed to sort of encourage accidents, because we don't know much about how to do this. So basically, our theory is encourage accidents, and maybe things will start. I think the other thing is that there seem to be, and I don't know if it's the same in the things that you've been involved with and know about, but there seem to be a small number of people who are very good at translation and who go to one area, steal something, bring it back to another area, or who are able to have a conversation with people who do something different. And I think most of what at least I know about, and, you know, collaboration between people with even slightly different training is a combination of encourage accident and try to have some of those people who have that facility of translating.
The butterfly effect. Is it like, you know, people who are able to pick up something from a place and then put it together and fertilize, you know, another. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a specific skill set. And when you get into talking about large-scale design projects, one of the roles of designers in particular, and also I think ethnographers who can work across disciplines, is exactly that, is to be able to actually translate between different forms of knowledge, facilitate processes, help the kind of artifacts manifest. And I've learned in putting teams together, artist, scientist, designer, or ethnographer, you know, not to throw the artists and the scientists into the same room together without somebody who's there to facilitate and moderate and help things kind of move to the next level. But I think science often doesn't have the designer in the midst or the person to facilitate in the same way. I'm going to show you a little bit from this project that I've been working on forever. It's kind of done in some ways, although I'm about to publish a lot of stuff from it. And it's called the Code Zebra Project. There's a website you can go to. There's also a website you might find really interesting if you want to look at art and science collaboration called www.horizonzero.ca, and it has about 20 volumes of a magazine gallery that will show you lots of really interesting art and science collaborations and all the debates and the theory behind them, and it's quite visually generous and kind of fun. So I decided in the late 1990s to create a website that would facilitate artists and scientists talking together online. And what I've been doing at the Banff Center was putting together these really intense summits where people were face-to-face. So one of my favorites was called Carbon versus Silicon, thinking small, thinking fast. And I brought together five people who were leading the new nanotech institutes around the world, including at Cambridge and what became Lund in Alberta, and Jim Huth at UCLA. Bunch of science fiction writers, artists, designers, physicists of different ilks, and chemists, people into chemistry because of how, you know, nano was sort of playing up. And nanotechnology was, and people who were doing all the policy work on it, threw them together, heavily facilitated for essentially 3 days, and just had people try and talk to each other across their disciplinary knowledge. And it was a really exciting event, but one of the things that we, and the science fiction writers were really fun too. They're great because they were able to kind of narrativize things, and the artists were looking at different models to kind of try and understand and represent, and the physicists were talking across different kinds of physics, which was interesting. Anyhow, we then spent a whole day building a nanotech dream home, which was like the home of the future, trying to take all of this sort of knowledge and imagine it as a space where all of the potential technologies and ideas were kind of flowing. So if you want to see that, go to Horizon Zero. So having facilitated these kinds of conversations for years, I just decided I should build a software, essentially, that allowed people to work together and build conversations in an online space. And then as I got more and more involved in actually building this space, I built the software, which was a visualization of emotion in debates between people from different disciplines, and found patterns to represent the different kinds of emotional effects. So we ended up building essentially a series of prototypes for the software. This is all kind of design. This is attempting to actually take the way that people are with each other emotionally, code it, because, you know, this was obviously building software, and then express it through a pattern, which was really fun to do and incredibly difficult as well. And then to take that and then
take it through a series essentially of prototypes and workshops in which we took the software, took the ideas, and kind of acted them out with each other. So these are the champagne loomed large there for clear reasons. But anyhow, to kind of take the process of working together and thinking about how these dialogues could happen and then represent them in a software environment. So here we are working together in a workshop system, of course. Lots of dialogue about, you know, between computer scientists, artists, how you in fact look at representing emotion, what kind of visual language would work, how people could engage with the software, and so on. So we then built three prototypes, essentially, over a number of years, and tested those. And the ways that we tested them were through a series of events. This is an event I facilitated on biotech and conversations with people from, again, different disciplinary knowledge, where we would get together and actually use the software to have a conversation. And then the project that I did that was probably the most significant with this was at the DEF Festival, which is the Dutch Electronic Arts Festival. In 2003, I locked up teams of artists and scientists. So I spoke to all of the artists and scientists who I thought would enjoy talking to each other, and people volunteered. And then over a 24-hour period, they were locked up together. It was sort of like an early reality television show, but for artists and scientists. So they were in this, we built this beautiful little apartment for them on top of the festival. It had a great view of the Rotterdam Harbor, and catered it. So hence your point about good food, very important. Catered it and brought in all manner of technology. So they were essentially under surveillance. They also could use the software to communicate with the outside world. And there were video conferencing lines going back and forth between this little apartment and the festival. And I was locked into the festival for 24 hours too. So I was sort of moderating them. And then people around the world could chat with them online and could see them talking to each other. And then I had moderators who came in every 3 or 4 hours, somebody who was an expert from the science that they were talking about or the art practice that they were engaged with would actually join online and chat with them. And they were essentially given the challenge of inventing new ideas, something that was tangible, new theory and a set of projects that would come out of this process. So every 4 hours, the documentary crew would come up and they'd document them and interview them. And there were hundreds of people at the festival watching and thousands of people around the world watching this process. And it was just a very interesting way of thinking about how to take this problem of producing a conjoined culture and boundary objects and see what could come out of it. My job was, in a sense, to be the moderator, ethnographer, designer, and keep them talking and have them actually not only talk, but sketch things, invent things. So it was quite a successful project, actually. They one of the teams who was a young physicist who also had a kind of This is the apartment, so it's quite beautiful. It's where they were. Who had an engineering background as well. So here, this is the view of the harbor, and this is the space that they were in. This is Nina Wakeford, who's herself an ethnographer, and Paul Wong, who's a performance artist, and someone who does a lot of documentary work but kind of uses ethnographic techniques. They were locked up together for 24 hours, and it was very interesting to see how their identities themselves sort of began to conjoin. And Paul was interviewing Nina and having her, she didn't know how to use a cigarette lighter, which was really interesting. So there was this one moment where he was training her on how to use a cigarette lighter and having her do performances with flashcards. And then she was writing her findings on the wall and putting academic citations down. And it itself became a kind of performance. So sort of interesting to see how they found a way of actually talking with each other using their language. And then Mary Flanagan, who is a games designer and a graphic artist, and Tom Donaldson were the other two, the physicist. And so this is their space that they were in. And this is downstairs in the festival. People could kind of lounge and watch them, and they were projected on these big screens. And at points, thousands of people would come through and sort of watch this process. And this is me downstairs with people around as I'm sort of mediating the process between them. But I think what was really interesting in this is it's a method I actually would like to adopt, because it was incredibly productive. The people who were locked up in that space are still working together. They built a kind of common language. They built a lot of sketches. They actually created something that they described as a mnemonic heap, which was a sculpture of artifacts that they collected over the course of the 24 hours and then built together and photographed. Were able to, because they were sort of forced together in this manner that was highly facilitated and also, I think, interestingly performative, because people were watching them emerge this culture very, very quickly. So what I learned from doing this is that there may be ways of, and then I went to the University of Turquoise. I said I worked a lot with the Finns and presented the research that we did and took the software and kind of developed it and sort of took it to the next level. What I learned from this process was that there may be a way when we want to try and work together where we have to, in a sense, create a sort of endurance test. And again, artists are very good at this notion that you have to have concrete outcomes, timelines, and a way of building these boundary objects that are just great meals, that are kind of representations of this moment of sort of coming together that we create very quickly, and then we sort of deconstruct afterwards and then use those as a way of building projects. So it's actually become a way that it's become a method of working. We built in some ways our strategic plan at our university in some very similar ways, where we kind of brought together people from very different disciplines, locked ourselves in a room, and did a lot of playing and sketching, even more than talking, and kind of came up with ideas about what would bring us together in the future that way. So maybe I'll just pause there and again try and come back to a conversation about, you know, again, how your methods work and don't work with this, your ideas about what you'd like to do with artists, ways that we could maybe think about some fast-track workshops between Perimeter and some of the people who are in the culture that I represent around things that you're interested in. Because I think that's also how the process happens, is a kind of matchmaking of conjoined interests that also have that sort of connection. Again, I'll pause. Yes.
I'm just thinking that one area where there's clearly overlap between art and science is in science communication. Mm-hmm. So how to communicate physics to people. And that's something that I think Perimeter is a big thing. And Perimeter Institute's one of our main goals is science outreach. So I mean, I know that I have active friends in Toronto, conversations with them about, you know, how should we communicate various things. And I always have my very systematic way of sort of developing something like textbook style, and they don't think that's very good, right? So they always have a very different way. So I've learned a lot.
So how do they work?
Well,
how do they work with your ideas? Like, what is it that they do that maybe destabilizes your way of working, but also takes those ideas somewhere else?
I think it's a different creative process in a lot of ways. I mean, physics should be a creative process, but we're never really taught how to be creative. And that was the one thing that I learned from them, is that, you know, they, like, as actors, like, you know, going through drama programs, they have courses where they're, you know, designed to learn how to be creative, mm-hmm. and think about creativity. And for us, I mean, even though it's a very important part of our job, we never really do that or learn that. So you're asking me what was different about it.
Have you worked with them, though? Have you actually taken an idea?
Have I done something? So when we started, very quickly.
Because one of the projects, actually, that maybe if we've got a couple of minutes, I'll show you this this other project that we worked on. Because it's, again, a way of sort of making concrete process. This is, if you remember, I talked about building these sort of location-based mobile experiences. And we expanded the design process. We did a lot of work with people, both kids who were on their mobile phones all the time and adults. And as I said, did a lot on the site. And this is one of the design groups working together. We were working on actual trails, working with Park Canada and their maps and all of this. So one of the things we did as a team, because it really was this amazingly hybrid team, is we very quickly built a couple of prototypes together. So that's what I mean about sketching. So this was like the engineers who hadn't worked a lot with artists and designers before, because you need pretty hardcore engineering skills to work in the mobile space. Like, it's fairly tough. And it's not a translated space, let's say that. And it certainly wasn't when we were starting to do this work, which was 2003, 2004. So one of the things that we did, which was a sketch, but it was really, and this would be for me a boundary object project, because it was able to kind of become the symbol for this project that became more and more difficult as we raised the caliber of what we were trying to do as we went forward, but in ultimately very successful project, is this piece here is called the flower throw. And in the park, you would know this from Ontario too, you're not allowed to pick stuff, right? And so we wanted to find a way that people could capture the species that were in the park, but also to build something that had this sort of emotional, kind of romantic feel to it. So what we figured out how to do was to, as you walked in the park, a seed would jump onto your mobile phone that was actually indigenous to the area. And it would plant itself there, and you could blow on your phone, and I should actually get my bucket. And you could blow the seed to somebody else. So it was quite romantic in that way, cute. And it would jump onto their phone. And then it would start to, and if they moved towards you, it would grow. And if they moved away, it would recede. So you were able to plant a garden that way. So you could actually jump all these seeds onto your phone and send them to somebody. And it was a little flirtation device in a certain way. And it worked. It was incredibly hard to do. You know, you had to figure out the GPS. You had to figure out the sensor systems, proximity. You had to figure out, you know, how to represent this stuff simply on a mobile interface, which, you know, isn't so easy. And it worked, and it was beautiful. And it was this piece that became the symbol for the project. Like, all this knowledge was impacted into this little thing that we built on this device. And it, what, every time there'd be problems, and there were many, I have to tell you a funny story. This is a funny, okay, so then I'm also going to talk about boundary objects in terms of documents. So this is a fantasy game that we built in the park that was very difficult to do and had many, many layers of planning in it, and the games designers who were used to working in these grand scale ways had to kind of bring that down to the park and make it the graphics work. But anyhow, it was an animal fantasy game where you had to keep little baby animals alive in the park that you adopted that were actually of the habitat and were endangered in various ways, and also had predators that were also in the game, etc. So rather complex game, running through actual locations, an actual height with different sorts of terrain in it, with different sorts of threats, etc.
And we started all on phones.
Yes, all on the phone. So you're actually running around in the park doing this. You'd hear something, you'd look at your phone, you would have a clue there, or another animal would be threatening you. You'd be told what to do. You had to save your creature. You had to feed it. You had to put it to sleep so it would stay alive. And this was this game that we were building, right? So, and we did a lot of work with kids to see what they wanted to play. We built the characters. Did a lot of participatory design to kind of think about how to make this thing happen. incredibly hard to engineer. Used a set of sketches, lots of participatory design. So one of the things that was fantastic about it was we realized that no one had yet designed a really effective gaming engine for a mobile phone, and we haven't to this day, actually. And so the engineering team, the really great engineers, decided also that they would build this technology, which was essentially an authoring system for mobile location-based experiences that designers could create content for that would run automatically on an AI system, and that XML programmers could kind of help the designers to get the information organized to get onto the phone. And it was built. It exists in C++. It works in Java. It works in Symbian. And the Banff Center's been working with RIM as a collaborator. We were working with Hewlett-Packard and Nokia, blah, blah. Everybody's very excited about this thing we were building. So essentially, built this engine, very hard to make it work. But the engineers, and it took me a year into the project, and I was like the principal investigator, to figure out that they actually thought that all designers knew how to code. So they really genuinely thought, we'd have these conversations on this thing that we were building, and they'd say, oh yeah, it's completely user-friendly, and they'd show this interface, which was beautiful. I don't know if I've got it here. It was beautiful. It's a beautiful interface. You actually see the, you know, the pattern of what's happening, you see the location. So you would think, as a designer, I could just take this and put it there. And meanwhile, they're engineering away in C++ or Java, and they just think, well, all the designers know XML, don't they? And it took a year in to figure out that they built this technology that assumed a whole other computing language. And it was this really wonderful aha moment in a cross-disciplinary collaboration where we then figured out how to bring in the XML people, et cetera, et cetera. And we're about to open source this engine, by the way, if anyone's interested in it. But it was one of those fantastic moments in misunderstanding on a project that, you know, was a very successful project in many ways. And what I learned from it, again, was the need for constant translation. And part of the problem was that the designers built things like this in treatments, and the engineering guys built these technical specs. And there wasn't a space in between on a kind of visual boundary object, which is a document, that would say this becomes this becomes this. So all of that sort of translation, again, between disciplines is, for me, such an interesting place where you have to sort of sketch things and create things and make meaning between them. So this is the last thing that we built. It's called The Haunting. It uses the engine. It had both kinds of engineers, XML, and it had the C++ people. This is some of the work we're doing to figure out using Cat's Cradle as a kind of navigation system. This game, this is another game we built called The Haunting. It takes place in Montreal on Mount Royal near the cemetery. And the idea was to bring the characters who are in that cemetery alive, so they would jump onto your mobile phone. So if you've ever seen Blair Witch, the movie, this is like Blair Witch, but you actually play it on Mount Royal, and you play it, you couldn't play it in the cemetery. That would have been inappropriate in terms of the dead. But they have no respect for the boundaries of the cemetery, so they're quite willing to jump onto your phone, even if you're close to them. And so this is what the cemetery looks like. This is just our team doing all the planning and all the work on, you know, figuring out the locations. So essentially, we had this idea that if you put the phones together, it's like a Ouija board. And so I think there's a picture here of a Ouija board somewhere. Maybe not. Yeah. And so you would essentially summon the dead. And you have to exorcise the ghost. So you have to figure out which of the eight, you play in teams of eight, you have to figure out who's haunted. And then you have to create these puzzles by putting your phones together, by finding people and finding pieces on the phone to exorcise the ghost. So, and there's little movies that run on your phone that tell you give you clues and tell you where to find people, and of course a map that helps you track where you are. So here, we're summoning. And so people are traversing the space trying to find the ghost. And this is a lot of the planning process of just, you know, figuring out the location. And then this is kind of interesting because this is all of the, this is sort of where, what we ended up doing to try and create these translation devices or boundary objects, essentially, between the engineers, the artists, the designers, to be able to understand how everything had to work so we could all talk to each other. This is just a specification created by a designer to try and help the engineers understand what they wanted to have happen. And this is what this is the interface the engineers built that everybody thought they could just plug designs into because of using visual representation, which designers then thought, oh, okay, that will work for me. So, and the other thing that we just put onto into the project, which was very interesting, was we had ethnographers studying us as we were actually working on the project to evaluate both the experience of users within the system, but also our own working methods. So, there you go. It's a good end. So, here, that's it.
I'm always struck by interactions with artists that you all do research, and somehow it's not what we think, but you all do research as much as we do research. And the question that you raise is, and I appreciate what Sean said. I mean, we are involved a lot in communicating to the public, but in very stereotypical ways, and very, you know, we're scientists and we're going to tell the public what to do, not what to do, but, you know, what is interesting, how to think about it, and so forth. And we're interested in, but not very good at, ways in which we, as people on the boundary of knowledge, can interact with other people on the boundary of knowledge. And before I just start a question, there's one thing that I have to say, which is that it's a cliche to say that the artists are the people who are in charge of the future, in charge of looking out for the future, but this is the first time I think we have a talk from 2009 in this room. If you look at your slide.
I thought that would be funny.
So
just because of the time-space thing, which you and I had a big kind of go-to on, like in 2005 when I first arrived.
So, yeah. Any questions?
Yeah.
Sir, I have a huge question.
Yes.
Yeah. Time's too often, and I was babbling
yes.
yesterday about weird things. The centerpiece of which is that, in a way, if what I'm thinking is right, there shall not come a day in which science shall have figured it all out, that the future too perfect won't be.
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore we have to unite our entire humanity. A sentence that I can say, but I don't know what it means. So I'm going to ask you a question that was just asked to me at the University of Vermont by the provost. I was thinking of making a meta-college, which is an interesting word. And the idea is to do what I was saying, which is what you're doing. Now, take sort of all the disciplines that we know, all of human activity, and we can list them all, you know, from Joe the plumber of McCain fame, who, you know, does his stuff pretty well, to designers, to artists, to lawyers, to businessmen, to scientists, okay, the whole thing, or this whole range of human activity. What would it be, and how would one even begin, because you've been doing this for a long time, to try to get people to talk together in a way that could somehow bridge across. I'm just going to give you one image that I came up with, which I think is totally inadequate, but it's a start. Imagine a circle of fields, and get three adjacent fields, overlapping fields, to talk to one another, and see what they can find to bridge, and then try to draw it concentrically in. I don't know. Do you have any idea about how to do this?
Well, it is a great, it's a great image, you know, because there's also this need for the fields to talk, but then for pieces to drop off of that and go off and do their own piece and sort of reconnect it. Well, it's so interesting because we've gone through this whole process of redesigning my institution, which is making some people very happy and others, you know, there's certainly some pain involved. Because what we've done is we've chosen five thematic contexts that we think are the 15 hard problems, or as designers say, wicked problems for the next 20 years for the world. And so we've decided we have that sheer arrogance to think that we have to try and address these. So what we've done is we've created these collaborative frameworks around these five areas that bridge into the disciplinary areas and have these sort of meta structures where people are constantly talking to each other across the disciplinary boundaries, and where we've also drawn in people from other institutions to have those conversations where we don't have the knowledge. And what we have done is said we're not going, and we're also hiring transducers, which is sort of like the design term, but we're hiring three computer scientists, but who are art friendly and design friendly and kind of have this cross-disciplinary background, and somebody from medical research. So we're kind of putting people in the midst who come from these other places. It's to sort of sustain the capacity that you kind of need that's knowledge specific, and to keep training people in those spaces while the interdisciplinary space is actually working on projects and figuring out issues and all kinds of programmatic stuff that begins to filter into the disciplines and transform them. We do have ways of working as a school. It's part of why I went to OPED. It's because there's this system called Think Tank, which is essentially like a cross-disciplinary lab that designers came up with. That's fantastic. And I mean, it was a little experiment. It's now become generalized. So the entire design program, in a sense, does a lot of what I've been talking about. So they'll take on a problem. The students will spend 8 weeks, you know, working on it in some way or another. They'll then have results that they work in a very interdisciplinary way. Multiple faculty members are part of that team. So we've sort of taken that as a way of redesigning the entire institution in some ways. Obviously lots of resistance. It's actually starting to happen. And when it manifests, it's just incredible for the faculty. Like in most institutions, they didn't talk to each other. Or, you know, somebody decreed interdisciplinarity from the top, which I mean, I definitely have done. But there was enough of a groundswell up. And what's happened is the students have been pushing for this so hard, you know. And now that we're creating these structures to facilitate it, the faculty are actually, interestingly, engaged in a way that, you know, the first couple of years were so tough, but now people are going like, wow, I had no idea that you had this knowledge. And so it is a design, like I've really discovered it as a design issue. And I used a lot of these sort of brainstorming methods to get people to the point where they're comfortable. So
I want to add one thing.
Still, before, I mean, let me just see.
Yeah, go ahead.
The lights are set. Yeah, let's see.
So you're still talking about collaborations between art and design on the one hand, and science and engineering on the other hand, science and technology on the other hand. It seems that design and technology are somehow analogous to each other, and likewise art and science are. And certainly in design and technology, you're trying to produce useful objects, and the collaboration would be with that in mind. Whereas in art and science, this is what interests me, you're trying to come up with a different vision of reality. So the point of fundamental physics, at least, is to try and come up with some deeper theory, some deeper understanding of the nature of reality. If you look at a good theory, then you gain that insight. And I think likewise, in good art, if you look at some good piece of art, like a painting or something, then maybe the artist is trying to tell you something about reality, some particular vision on reality. What I would be interested in is how you get that kind of conversation going, that kind of collaboration going. I think that's much more difficult. So some of the collaborations I've seen between artists and scientists are really of the first kind, where you're using the materials of science to help, just really as a medium for art, and I collaborate with it. Whereas the other kind of fundamental discussion between about the nature of reality, I think that's deeply interesting, but I don't know how you make that happen.
But I think we had a kind of conversation.
Well, actually, like we did,
The second collaboration, like in the two Bach cups I did, the second one, which was between the physicist person, who did have some pragmatic, you know, computer science knowledge, as physicists often do, and the artist who had that kind of complexity theory and gaming background, was of that nature. I mean, they really were taught, they had some really interesting arguments about complexity theory, actually, because they both were coming at complexity from very different perspectives, and yet they were both incredibly well-educated in complexity theory. And so, but they really did have different ways of working with that. So, and then part of what began to be expressions were things that they could actually create together. So it wasn't only, you know, Mary going, I'm inspired by your idea of complexity, Tom, because you're a physicist, I'm going to go do this, and Tom going, wow, that's a new way of approaching this problem, I'm going to do that. There was this other place that was interesting, too, where they said, well, what happens if we actually try and make something together? What would it look like, feel like, what would it express, how would it embody these things? Because I think, I agree, artists do take science theory and appropriate it, and they take materials of science, which can be interesting, and do things with them. But I'm actually interested in a place where people do something together. And then, you know, the scientists can also go off and publish or push their theory, and the artists will go off and do their own whatever. But I'm very interested in those boundary objects, because they're not just ways of making people comfortable with each other, which maybe is a little bit how I bias the talk. They're like, it's like the flower throw thing. They're things that actually have this new way of understanding the world that somehow really takes the world to a next level, which is similar to what you're saying. But that's why I think it requires sometimes these hybrid methods to get there. So, and designers are helpful, though, because they can sometimes figure out the structure and the system through which the thing will be made. Design has really changed, and a lot of designers engage with complexity and theory as well.
So we have two more questions. Adrian, and then...
So my experiences may be a bit different. I found it incredibly easy to get communication going between artists and scientists and literary theorists and poets and so on. If there's a focus, if you have a discussion group or something that says, right, we're going to read plays about modern plays involving modern science, or poetry about medicine, anything like that, something everybody's got a little bit of a perspective on, and they're interested in hearing other perspectives on. Bring them together, and conversations flow from that. Projects, flow from that. And I wonder, have you tried?
The whole culture that I built at the Event Center were those dialogues, and they were really fun, and they were very elegant and exciting, and people. But they always were a point where I was interested in the rubber sort of hitting the road, which was, now what are we going to do? What are we going to make? How are we going to influence each other? Where does the world shift? Where does the understanding shift? You know, of how we understand the world, and then how do we keep track of how that expression moves through our own world in ways that are transformative? You know, so it's less the materiality that comes out of it that really interests me.
Of course, yeah.
So
my sense is, if it works well, the discussion's off. It becomes organic. I mean, those discussions seed projects that you never envisaged.
Yeah, it's hard to sort of see that always in terms of how the artwork works aesthetically, you know. I just think there's this sort of boundary space for how work is effective or not. So part of how I've begun to see art and science collaboration on a kind of creative level is that it's just the work is constantly negotiation. Like, you're always trying to understand what's being expressed, and it's never finished quite, you know. It's sort of like theory, you know, because it always is somehow influenced by this continual way of struggling with understanding something that's from an internalized sense. Seeing something from outside.
While you're talking, I was wrestling with trying to make what I was saying clear, but I don't think it's going to be. I'll just try anyway. So, like, one thing is, like, how far can you really achieve a synthesis between these perspectives? And isn't it good that you have these two different ways of doing things which are distinct? I mean, there was one example that I know of is our friend Blake Dalgo, who's a theoretical physicist, was working with an artist called Matthew Tickle. They did some really interesting things. Like, he wanted to, I guess his advantage in the situation is seeing things about the universe that were previously hidden to you.
Yeah.
So he was interested in this concept of things being hidden in various ways. So he was interested in the concept of cosmic waves which are penetrating us the whole time. So he put a Geiger counter into every room at Queen Mary College, for instance, which was attached to a light. And you see from the outside just a random flicker of these lights, so it would reveal this hidden structure to the universe. We all really like that one. And then there was other, for Faye, was one of her purposes was to propagandize people for a certain view of quantum mechanics. So she was trying to teach him this. And one of the things that happens is the people who were skeptical about this kind of thing were like, oh, well, you know, that's not a really faithful representation of our theory. Like at CERN, when they have people who wrap like ropes around a tree to illustrate twisting, people looked at it and thought, oh, well, that doesn't tell you much about science. And then on the other hand, you have people, I mean, you get the opposite thing as well, where people come from the artistic perspective, don't see what they need to get from the science. And so, I don't know, I'm just on the band of that, but I was trying to get to this point of what do you envision this synthesis giving us once it occurs? I mean, is it going to be an end to that kind of skepticism of people? I mean, how far is it going to go beyond just having to perspectives which are helpful in their separate ways to...
I think the metaphors you used were interesting. I think the first project sounds more viable than tree wrapping, because there's something about its aesthetics that work. And there's another example, Natalie Jerkovic, who actually we're bringing to OPEN, and I'll make sure that you know when she's here. She's just very interested in scientists. And I can't remember which lab she was in. It doesn't matter. Anyhow, she took wires and she put them throughout the lab, and essentially they were very beautiful. They were copper wires, and they had this vibratory kind of edge, and they make a sound, and basically they just monitored internet traffic. So they were like the very kind of reductionist view of the Ben Rubin Mark Hansen piece, but they were beautiful. And what it did is the entire lab kind of came alive every time there'd be an escalation of traffic. You just get this humming sound. And so it was this way of kind of understanding the kind of materiality of, you know, of light.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was light becoming sound, right? Because it was essentially light. You know, you're dealing with the internet, right? So you're dealing with light. So it was sort of interesting in terms of that kind of project. So and that's where and it helped the engineers somehow get a sense of the quantity of the volume of traffic. So it was a way of using abstraction, a really effective metaphor, something that was beautiful, something that was really simple, but was actually kind of world shifting to the scientists and the engineers who were working in the lab. So I thought as an art project it was really interesting for an artist. So I mean, I liked the first example a lot because it felt like for me it would allow, even if it was an argument for a certain theoretical perspective, it would allow people maybe to experience that perspective in a different way, which is partly the popularization of science.
Yeah.
But I think it's. So what do I expect from it? I work in visualization. I don't only do this sort of human visualization, and I've been looking at what's going on with visualization, science, and representation, and the work is just a whole other new art form, and it's beautiful, beautiful, and I think some of it is actually helping people make new kinds of discovery. So, yeah. Oh.
Good. Any last comment? Okay, well, thanks, Sarah, again.
Thank you.